Hello, everybody. This is Queer Voices, a home-produced podcast that has grown out of a radio show that's been on the air in Houston, Texas for several decades. This week, Brian Lavinka talks with Dr. Anne Robeson, the retiring CEO of Houston's Montrose Center.
It was first started to be just an affirming place for LGBTQ people to get affirming behavioral health services, mostly mental health at that time. And it started out as just a lot of part-time people pulling together to be able to serve people affordably.
And today on Queer Voices, I'm very excited to have Dr. Anne Robeson from the Montrose Center to come on Queer Voices and talk about her career in the Montrose Center itself. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
So who is Dr. Robeson?
I think for the last 35 years, I've kind of defined myself with my job. So, you know, CEO of the Montrose Center. In my personal life, I mean, I grew up in Pennsylvania. I've studied psychology and public health for many years. And I'm at home. I have an African gray parrot named Neely and a tortoise named Dewey.
So how did you end up in Houston and in the Montrose Center, or I guess the Montrose Counseling Center at the time?
Well, I ended up in Texas because I was married to somebody in the oil business, and we moved down to Port Arthur, and I got the heck out of there as fast as I could. And so I moved to Austin and worked for what was then Texas Department of Health and ran the sexual assault program for the statewide funding for that, and was the contract and program manager for that. And then that was in, when I moved to Houston, it was 1988, and it was still pretty early in the HIV pandemic. And I saw a blind ad in the Houston Chronicle and answered it and came in. And I guess at that time, a lot of the person before me had died of complications from AIDS. And at that time, there were a lot of the men in the field were sick, and I guess I knew more about the issues than anybody else had interviewed. So, but I sought out the center because when I worked in Beaumont at the Rape Crisis Center, I had a lot of clients over there who were lesbian, and there weren't really much services over there for them. And so I connected with what was then the Montrose Counseling Center, and got services for them if they could make the travel in Houston from the Montrose Counseling Center. And I remembered that. And I remembered I had talked to Jim Beecher at the time, and how nice he was and how helpful he was. And it was just a wonderful resource for the community, and one that you really notice when you don't have it, like we did in a small town of Beaumont.
What are some of the things that the Montrose Center provides, and what are the services that they give to the community?
When I do my tour, I always leave something out because it's a very complex organization. We've added a lot of things because either they just weren't available, or we had tried to get our clients the services at a mainstream organization and it didn't work out very well. And sometimes it's not just because the staff of that other agency isn't affirming or good. It's that if it's a group living situation or a group, the other consumers don't treat them very well. So after trying to get other organizations to serve the LGBTQ community well, and if that doesn't work, then we did it ourselves. So we do a lot of community education, particularly around cultural competency. We have a longstanding, since 1986, outpatient substance use disorder treatment license. And we have lots of things that wrap around that to help people who are in recovery, like recovery support services, 12-step programs at the 12-step groups at the center, a lot of outreach. We give out Narcan, which is it's not really the right word, but basically the antidote for somebody who's having an opiate overdose. We use the nasal spray.
we have a lot of HIV services, and most of those center around behavioral health, counseling, and substance use disorder treatment. But we do a lot of testing. We do HIV, hep C, and syphilis rapid testing out in the field and in the building. We do case management. We're the longest continuously serving case management organization since it first started in Houston in 1991. Then we have just some general counseling. We have a lot of graduate students that we accept as interns to help us do counseling, as well as our master's and PhD level counselors. We have a full anti-violence program that works with sexual assault, domestic violence, hate crimes, and human trafficking. And we do a lot of things that most sexual assault and domestic violence programs do, including immediate housing for people who are fleeing domestic violence. We have youth program. Of course, we absorbed Hatch into our programming in the early 2000s and have grown that. So we've got Hatch for 13 to 20 year olds. We've got Hatch Junior for 7 to 12 year olds. And kind of an next step for that is we have Rising Leaders, which are young professionals. And it's a more of a social group. So we started senior services in 2005, and Chris Kerr and I worked for about 10 years before he died to develop and learn everything we could about doing senior housing. And so we opened the Law Harrington Senior Living Center in, I believe it was, we had the first people moving in 21, early 21. And so that's been up and running for a couple of years now. And then probably the most recent services, we do have some psychiatry, very limited psychiatry. They have to be in counseling or case management with us, but we're using Baylor residents and a supervisor from Menninger to provide psychiatry. So I think that's everything.
That's all?
Wow. Yeah.
From that one little building on Brainard.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it used to be an even smaller building on Lovett and then Richmond. But and that's kind of why it's a complex position to replace. And the board and the search firm are working very hard to do that. But it's, I mean, the person that replaces me doesn't have to be an expert at any of these issues. They just need to, you know, they can learn all that stuff. They just need to really, the kind of the most important things are to be supportive of the mission. And we pride ourselves on being very ethical because we have so many areas that require confidentiality. One of the other issues is to be able to run a complex organization like this.
Let's step back a little bit. How did this all get started? Didn't it start out of the town meeting one?
It did. And the first board, I won't remember all their names, but certainly Marion Coleman was one, John O'Donnell, who was a psychiatrist, and of course, Bill Scott. Bill Scott was one of probably best classified as our first clinical director. And the meetings were held in Marion Coleman's living room. I think town meeting one was, it was the summer of 77 or summer 78, but we were incorporated by December of 78. So they did that very quickly. And it was first started to be just an affirming place for LGBTQ people to get affirming behavioral health services, mostly mental health at that time. And it started out as just a lot of part-time people pulling together to be able to serve people affordably, because again, if they went into somebody in private practice, it probably wouldn't have been very affordable. And a lot of the agencies at that time really, if they had gay counselors, they may not have been out. And it was just not a time where, usually if somebody went in for counseling, they would either try to fix them or, you know, kind of a conversion therapy, or they would just ignore the sexual orientation. And, you know, you have to deal with the whole package when you're helping somebody with whatever recovery they want to do. You have to allow them to express themselves and talk about all their issues.
Looking at your career at the Montrose Center, what is your greatest achievement that you've seen?
Of course, Law Harrington is the most recent. So that I'm very proud of, and very proud of the work that the board and the staff have done to pull that together. But I think just sometimes I say just the fact that we still survive is an accomplishment, because, you know, we've had pendulum swings of we're, you know, we're very in vogue or we're very hated. Sometimes we get a lot of hate mail. Sometimes we get people that want to put us out of business. And we've weathered all that. And we're still here and we're thriving. We're a $13 million organization now. I'm very proud of the fact that we're still here and that we have such a diversity and complexity of services to give to the community.
Is there any advice that you want to give to your successor?
One thing is to trust the staff. And, you know, there's a lot of licensed clinical people there. And I find the best solutions come when the management administrative side and the clinical side both talk to each other and come to a joint decision, because none of these decisions, especially about when, you know, a client's insurance doesn't work or trying to figure out how to pay for the therapy, you know, we always want to err on the client gets the services. It's often a complex discussion about how do we fund this and what are the clinical issues that, you know, are they in crisis? We want to make sure we don't drop the client in the midst of just trying to figure out how to fund it, because that shouldn't be their problem. So I would say one of my biggest pieces of advice is to really work closely with the staff and come to some common agreements, because if you just take a authoritarian view and don't listen to them, they often have very good points, and it's something that you can mediate through.
I assume there's a national board search going on for your successor.
The board has hired a search firm, and they are looking nationally. I know they've had at least some preliminary interviews. I don't think the board has done their round of interviewing yet, but the last I heard from the search firm, they were very confident that they're going to have somebody January 1 and that they've got some good candidates. So I'm encouraged. And one of the things I'm going to ask the community is for the community to support this person as much or more than they've supported me, because it's not going to be easy for them to come in and follow somebody, whether it was me or somebody else, that's been there for a long time. So it's be very important for the staff and the board and the community to support them fully.
And I have heard that you were going to stay on for a little while to kind of shadow them. Is that true?
Well, yeah, I'm half time afterwards. I won't be in the office because I don't want to confuse the staff. I want to make sure that this new person's authority isn't shadowed by me being there and them just being used to coming to me. So I'll be at home, but I will be available for a lot of transition discussions and support and making sure that none of the balls get dropped, because there's, like I said, it's very complex. We've got about 35 government grants, and there's, you know, reports and budgets and, you know, audits and all kinds of things and we're accredited Joint Commission, and we're also a certified community behavioral health clinic, and there's all kinds of nuances to all of those. And so part of my job, besides the initial making sure all the bank accounts get transferred and all that, is to just make sure that they're well oriented and briefed and to be available for consultation if they want. But I will be at their disposal, at the new CEO's disposal.
So what program are you most proud of at Montrose Center?
Well, I mean, the anti-violence one is the closest to my heart, because that's what my history was before I came there. And I'm very proud at how we've cobbled together with like six different small grants to put that program together. I'm very proud of all of the things we're able to do with that and how long it's been there. It's been there since the early 90s. And I'm also, of course, very proud of our senior services. You know, the reason we have those senior services is because of Jack Jackson. He was just my darling. He and I went to opening night of Gilbert and Sullivan every year. He was my opera buddy, and I made all his costuming for his drag outfits. And I have a life-size photo of him in my office that keeps me company every day. When his health started failing, and I helped, I was one of the people in rotation with EPA's care team for him. And I saw what he was going through, and not just what he was going through as an older man, but what he was going through with healthcare providers and whether or not they, you know, supported him. And, you know, he was never one to be in the closet, and he was always very vocal about who he was. You get to see things outside of Montrose. When you work in Montrose and you hang out in Montrose all the time, you just get the sense that everything's cool and everybody supports the gay community. And that's not always the case. So when you go with somebody to their healthcare appointments and you find out that maybe they're not so supportive of who the patient is, and then that extends to, okay, if this person has to leave their home and go into some, you know, assisted living, or even to, you know, we had some clients like Ralph Lasher went to an apartment outside the Loop and didn't feel safe around neighbors and, you know, leaving anything out in their apartment that might signal that they were gay, because you'd have home health workers coming in. So when Chris Kerr and I saw all that, we were just, okay, we really have to commit ourselves to having an affirming space for seniors, both behavioral health wise, but in every aspect we can think of. So we've tried to really beef up the services around our senior community. And, you know, what we heard from them a lot was, look, you know, the younger generation wouldn't even have half of the benefits or the services or the organizations that they do now, if not for the people of that age group. And they didn't always feel like they were appreciated. We initiated with our fundraisers a senior discount, because they said, you know, I get senior discount at McDonald's for my coffee. None of the fundraisers want us there because we're not, you know, the pretty young boys anymore. And so we tried to make them welcome even at our fundraisers to make sure that they were honored for all the work. And me being somebody who's over 60, I get that.
Well, I think we're getting older now and we're not dying from HIV. At least the right. Gay men. So it's like, what's next for our community? And I think the Law Harrington is a wonderful solution to that issue. And kudos to you and to the Montrose Center for creating such a wonderful entity.
Well, and we appreciate Legacy for being a strong partner in that. There is a small primary care clinic right inside the front door.
And I have to disclose that I am on the board of Legacy, and we work very closely with the Montrose Center.
Yeah, and we appreciate that partnership.
We're speaking with Ann Robison.
Robison.
I've always said Robison, of the Montrose Center. Truth be told, you are not a lesbian. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Everyone thinks that you're a lesbian.
Well, when I was first hired and it was discovered that I was an ally, I got a lot of pushback from the staff, from the community. It was pretty brutal, but I just pushed through. And like I said, I've been very active, and this is where I met Deborah Bell. I was very active in Texas National Organization for Women and worked alongside a lot of lesbians, lesbian couples. And when I was in Pittsburgh, my mentor in Pittsburgh was the CEO of Pittsburgh Action Against Rape. And her name was Ann Pride, and she took the last name Pride so that she was not taking any name from any patriarchal ancestors in her history. So I, you know, I don't like people who say, well, I have a lot of friends who are lesbian, but I mean, I felt like I was very comfortable within the community. But I would say over the years, there have been a lot of people in the community that supported me and kind of turned that tide and helped me and supported me in helping provide services to the community. One was Marion Coleman. Another was Tori Williams and Renee Tappy. And Anise Parker has been very supportive. So, and then there's been some on the male side too, certainly Ray Hill and Jean Harrington. Jean Harrington was a jewel. An irreverent jewel, and Jack Jackson and Andrew Edmondson. So there have been a lot of people who have kind of lifted me up and accepted me within the community, because it's quite an honor to hold this position, which everybody thinks is very powerful. I don't necessarily think it's very powerful, but it's a position that's central in the LGBTQ community.
And I just, at least for the last probably 30 years, I've felt very supported and embraced.
We have a gala coming up, the Out for Good gala. Can we talk about that?
Yes, sure. Yes, Kennedy will be happy if we talk about that.
So you're being honored, I understand.
It's our 45th anniversary, and I came in, the 10th anniversary of the center, the party was like a few days before I started, so I was able to come in and go to the party. But so I've been there 35 years, and yes, I think it's Community Visionary is the name of the award, which Ray has gotten before, Marion has gotten before. And there's been several people that have gotten the award. And I think Tommy Ross, they're going to do that. And I actually have some family members coming in from Pennsylvania to celebrate with me.
So that's going to be October 6th, Friday night.
Yes.
It's open at 7 p.m. It's at the ballroom at Bayou Place. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so you're receiving an award. Now, I've always heard stories about the Montrose Center. Do you have anything that you want to share before we go?
Every day, there's at least one crisis, and that can take the flavor of somebody being very upset in the lobby. It can take the flavor of some legislator, wanting us to disappear. It can take the flavor of somebody wanting to honor us. So, I mean, there's just so many stories I wouldn't even know where to begin. I have to say, probably my biggest joy in my as I go through my monthly routine is meeting with our prevention staff. They're not licensed, but they're certified and trained in all kinds of things. They do HIV testing. They're out on the street. They risk getting arrested by the police who don't believe they're out there providing services because of where they are. And we actually did have one get arrested by Metro Police once. And the resourcefulness of those staff members, how they are able to get clients around wait lists at clinics and get them in the back door. They're able to find clothing for them. They're able to find housing for them when, you know, nobody else can. Meeting with them every month and hearing their stories and the ways they're able to help people is so heartening. And I guess one of the stories one of our recovery coaches I like to repeat is, he had a client who was addicted to pain medication. And, you know, we ask them to take just real baby steps on how do you get towards your goal. And the person's goal was to get their teeth fixed because that what was causing the pain and started the use of pain meds. He talked them through every step of, you know, how do we make an appointment? What do we have to do to get there? What bus do we have to take? How early do we have to get up? And go through all those steps with him to get him to the place where he got his teeth fixed. And then we can start working on the addiction. And that is exactly what that crew at the center does, is they take wherever the client is, whatever their issues is, whatever they want to work on, that's where we start. And we help them meet their goals and help them see how they can have a better life by making these small changes.
You know, I always heard the story of the early days where you had to go into the Coke machines and get money out to pay the employees.
Absolutely. And at the time I was married and our receptionist had a teacher's retirement. So we both held our paychecks until everybody else got paid. But yes, that is legendary. They also laugh at me for picking up paperclips all over the place on the floor. And that's not only because I don't want to have to buy paperclips. We don't have to, but I also don't want them to tear up the carpet when they run the vacuum over it. So yes.
So my last question for you, Ann, is what's next for Ann Robinson?
A number of things. I've told people my dad is 94 and he lives by himself out in the country in Pennsylvania and he's still driving, which scares the bejesus out of me. But I'm going to go spend a longer time than I'm usually able to with him in February when his birthday is. I'm going to travel. You know, Katie Caldwell and I travel quite a bit, and I travel with my partner and some other friends. So we've got some trips planned. I have a quilt that I started in 1981 that I still haven't finished that I want to finish. And my mother, when she died, left me a unfinished crocheted tablecloth that I have to finish.
And then the thing that the staff laughs at me the most about is that I'm addicted to Korean dramas. And so I will be watching even more of those now than I have been.
Where can people find out more information about the Montrose Center?
Oh, certainly at our website, montrosecenter.org. And you can drop by. We take walk-ins that, you know, we do tours. If anybody wants a tour, they can call us and we can do a tour of either the services building or La Harrington. Best place to get started is at the website.
We've been speaking with Ann Robeson, the executive director of the Montrose Center, doing amazing work and stepping down after 35 years of wonderful service. Thank you for coming on, Ann.
Thank you.
This is Queer Voices.